Welcome to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardot. In 2012, Michael Engelhard, an outdoor guide, writer, and anthropologist, decided to hike and paddle from Canada to Kotzebue, traversing the Brooks Range. They're not the first to make the trip, and just the start of the through-hike trend occurring in the far north, Engelhard brought his unique Alaskan background to the trip. This spring, the Mountaineers published his memoir of the trip, Arctic Traverse. The book is a mix of travelogue, natural and cultural history, and philosophy. Michael joins me to discuss his motivations for the trip, how the book came about, doing a two-month solo trip, the natural history of the Brooks Range, and his musings on wild lands and development. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardot, and I have with me Michael Engelhard, author of Arctic Traverse, and he's on Zoom. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Welcome, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Hey, excellent book. I've really enjoyed reading it. And tell us a bit about it. Give us maybe a brief overview of what it's all about.
Well, for the longest time, it didn't look like there was even going to be a book. You know, I did this traverse from the Canadian border, the Yukon border, to Kotzebue through the entirety of the Brooks Range in 2012, actually. Turned out to be a 58-day adventure, so 600 miles on foot going west from the Canadian border, and then 400 miles on the Noatak River all the way to Kotzebue Sound. And like I said, I did this in 2012 and tried to shop the idea around for the book about it because it was a pretty exciting trip, as you can imagine. And there was no takers at those days. You know, nobody was interested, and I'd kind of given up on it already. And then a couple of years ago, I approached Mountaineers Books with Alaska essay collection on which they passed. However, the editor saw that I'd mentioned the Arctic Traverse in two of those essays and said, well, you know, if you ever end up writing about that, we would definitely interested in taking a closer look at it. So, and at that point, you know, I'd taken my notes of the Traverse on my maps, on my topographic maps, because I always had them handy every day, and I wanted to save the weight on a notebook. And I hadn't even at that point even transcribe my notes from the maps, but then when she said they were interested in possibly doing a book about it, I got down and the summer before last, spent the entire summer in a mad rush getting that thing together, doing all the research and transcribing all the notes and all that good stuff. So that was quite the adventure by itself.
So the book is you are basically hiked and floated from the Canadian border to Kotzebue, correct? And so it's part travelogue, but what I found fascinating, it's a lot of natural history also, right?
Yeah, you know, it's always been a strong emphasis of mine, being a guide and an outdoors instructor with various youth programs and academic programs like Rocky Mountain Field Institute, to educate people, not just to entertain them, but to keep them safe in the outdoors. And I learn that way too. You know, I see something I haven't encountered before, I read up on it. And to me, you know, I don't want to just write it. I went this and did this cool thing and I'm such a cool guy. You know, I want to really get people a little bit to care about these places that I came to care about. And you got to back up your opinions too. That's the other thing. I'm a pretty opinionated guy and you better have the facts to back up your opinions.
Yeah, that comes across in the book, and we'll get to that later in the show, some of your thoughts about things. Because it's also, it's a natural history, but it's also philosophy. And you mentioned to me earlier that you like to teach people, too, like you like to educate people.
Yeah. You know, minds need always to be expanded as for my own. And I don't, you know, a lot of people have the opinion that once you leave school, you know, your studies, you're done learning, but that's sort of like a wasted opportunity. And I had a job first before I went back to university in my 30s, and I really embraced it and got the most out of it. And I think learning is a lifelong process, and it should be fun too, you know. Yeah. It shouldn't be a chore. It's a privilege, actually.
Let's talk about that a little bit. How'd you get in the outdoors as a kid, and like what sort of spurred you into this that culminated in this trip?
My dad was really taking us everywhere when we were little kids as a family. Mom and my brother and me, we went to Switzerland skiing and Austria skiing every spring, and then the summers we'd go camping on the North Sea coast and in other places. And so I got that, you know, camping out and roughing it, so to speak, on the beach and stuff. I got that early with my mother's milk almost. And then I joined the military, actually, and that was a formative experience too. I was airborne infantry, so we were creeping out around in the woods quite a bit, you know, going through culverts underneath roads and stuff, doing ranger training, eating tree bark bread and all those things. So that kind of gave me an idea that minimal camping can actually be kind of fun and roughing it, you know, a little bit. I know it sounds kind of macho, but, you know, that's how I came to it. And then, you know, we did a lot of things like my brother, my father and I, we climbed Europe's highest mountain, Mont Blanc, together as a family venture. So these things were definitely formative. And I dedicate, the book is actually dedicated to the memory of my dad because he was instrumental in that.
Now, a lot of people, Michael, would not consider the military fun, but apparently it was fun enough to for you to stick with the outdoor thing, right?
I was a different person then, you know. I really changed up in that regard, but it gave me some hand, you know, some handy tools and some really appreciation of simple things.
Yeah, and then so you're out of the military. Then what?
Well, that's actually, I had some money and time to burn and didn't know quite what I wanted to do with my life. And, you know, I went straight from high school in the military, not to college. And so then I decided I wanted to travel the United States. And I took a half a year to tour the Southwest, ended up all the way down in Mexico and Guatemala, and was really impressed with the people and the place, you know, this whole idea of the national parks. And I fell really in love with the country and with the people. And wanted to stay that time, but I couldn't find a way to make it happen. So I had to kind of slink back into Germany with my tail between my legs. But I had two experiences in particular that really shaped sort of the things to come. Was that I was hitchhiking mostly, and I got invited to spend some time with the Hopi family, a traditional Hopi family. Uh-huh. And then also down in Mexico, I went to an island that was uninhabited, that just has a biological research station off the coast of Yucatan, and spent some time with Mexican fishermen there that seasonally live there. And sort of that triggered my interest in foreign cultures, and that led eventually to the anthropology studies, you know, the university studies, and that's what ultimately brought me to Alaska.
Yeah, and that was to UAF, is that right?
Yes, that was to UAF, and that was a pretty funny story there, too, because I had, you know, I always wanted to live up north for a long time. I just probably too much Jack London during my formative years, and the whole romance of cabin life and all that stuff. And so I was halfway through my anthropological studies in Munich, and I was applying for a scholarship for an exchange, just a year abroad as an exchange student. And I did get a pretty coveted scholarship, but it was for the University of Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada. And I had been to Edmonton, and it's a big city, and it's in the middle of the plains, a long ways from the mountains. And then, lo and behold, I saw a picture of UAF, the campus here in Fairbanks, on the West Ridge, and the view that you have on a clear day of Denali. And I said, you know, I'm going there. Forget about Edmonton, you know. And my friends were saying, like, you're crazy letting all this money for the scholarship go and all that. But it turns out it was one of the most momentous decisions of my life, you know, coming to UAF. Because it ended up being much more than a year abroad. I ended up auditing classes at first, but then I really liked the program and they liked me. And so I they managed to get me into the full-time, into the graduate school program there. And it's one of the best programs for Northern anthropology in the world, probably. And I got a teaching assistantship and a research assistantship and a visa change that came with it, and ended up going out fishing in Northwest Alaska, fishing and hunting with the Inupiaq elders, and got paid for it. So that was pretty nice.
Yeah. And that was, I think, somewhat influential also in this book. You talk a lot about your time in those villages.
Yeah, because I had seen some of these areas that I was traveling through. I had seen those before, and I knew a lot of things already because I'd interviewed a lot of the elders up there on the Alatna and the Koyukuk Rivers that had traveled into the Brooks Range as part of a multi-year study that we were doing for the Park Service that I was involved in, a land use and subsistence study. So I already had a lot of, you know, Kayana being to those villages on the Kobuk and a lot of places up there, Anaktubuk and so on. So it was almost like revisiting some of these familiar haunts, but, you know, tying them together in one long expedition.
And also, what about the natural history part of it? I mean, the amount of information and really interesting information about the things you saw, the animals, plants, rocks, lichen, where'd all that come from? You must have studied up on that also.
Well, I certainly didn't carry the natural guidebooks out there with me, but, you know, I have a background in cultural anthropology that deals with subsistence and land use, so I'm already having an interest in the different animal species and how people utilize them. And, you know, just talking to these elders, they read the landscape like an open book, and they knew the animals so well, you know, just from observing them a lifetime. So I absorbed a lot of that by osmosis. But then I just took the notes, and some things I didn't know what they were. And then when I got back, I did the research and figured out what it was actually what it was that I had seen or encountered, you know, by perusing all the natural history libraries and all the guidebooks and that. But I traveled light, so I had only one book, and that was sort of like a nonfiction adventure read that, you know, I didn't bring a whole library there.
Yeah, I like those. It seemed like food and reading were very important to you on the trip.
Well, and you know, telling myself jokes and stuff like that, making up little ditties and stuff, because sometimes you do get into monotonous stretches there, and where the mind really does wander, and you're not, you know, looking at every tussock that you jump over.
Yeah, and we haven't mentioned that, but it was a solo trip.
Yes, it was a solo trip.
Right.
And not by choice necessarily, but I just couldn't find anybody who had the time or the inclination to come along at that time.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your sort of leading up to this. What are some of your heroes, some of the, you mentioned Jack London, some of the influential writers and thinkers that you came across in your career?
Of course, the Alaskan conservationists that were involved with creating refuges and parks up there. So the Murrays, my wife was actually an intern at the Murray Ranch in Wyoming. So I got to go there and meet some of the people involved with that. And then in Gates of the Arctic, of course, we have Bob Marshall, who was really a character, not just, you know, as a writer. He may not be my model as a writer, but he definitely is as a personality. He had this really buoyant sense of humor and spontaneity, and was really a pretty hardcore hiker and outdoors person too. And he'd originally, sort of like me, only come up there to study trees, you know, near the tree line to do some dendrochronology work. But then he sort of got totally sucked into the wilderness up there, the whole experience in the Wiseman area, and going and exploring some of these areas that not many white people had seen at that point. And so I strongly identified with that.
Yeah.
Then
anybody else?
You know, heroes is a kind of loaded concept. There's aspects I like and aspects I don't like. But what I admire about those people is that they were actually spending a lot of time out in the areas that they were trying to protect, you know. And nowadays, you're hard-pressed to find conservationists that, you know, they're mostly up in Washington lobbying, it seems, and don't actually get to spend a lot of time learning about these places that they're trying to protect and, you know, traveling in them. So I always appreciated that. You know, people like George Schaller, the wildlife biologist, who was actually a student of the Murrays, when they went up in the Sheenjack. And I was blessed to see him speak here. He actually gave the commencement speech at my graduation here at UAF, the only commencement speech that he ever gave. And in retrospect, I almost would have become a wildlife biologist rather than a cultural anthropologist.
Yeah. And I also think of the, you do a very good job in the book of incorporating indigenous knowledge, and you had some influential elders, like you mentioned, that seem to be equally or more important to you.
Yeah, because it was their country in the first place, you know, and I think people don't give that enough credit. Like when we talk about wilderness, it's a very loaded concept. What to us was wilderness, to them was home, or still is home, you know. And this whole idea, what are we talking about when we're talking about wilderness? Well, if for you that means it's the absence of human or the near absence of humans, then we haven't really seen wilderness here in North America in 20,000 years, you know?
Yeah.
Since the first people arrived.
Yeah. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. I'm talking to Michael Engelhardt, author of Arctic Traverse, which is going to be released here in early April. Michael, I think you have maybe a reading about sort of one about the trip and one about sort of how the book came about. You want to share that, one of those, with us?
Yeah, sure. I'll start out on what I call the origin stories, what made me actually want to go out and do this thing. And I'll read a little bit and then I'll sum up the rest, because there was a whole series of events that led to me actually eventually doing it. Okay, where am I here? Oops, got the wrong one. Hold on for a sec. I got my bookmarks all mixed up. All right. Okay, as I mentioned before, I ended up, you know, not finishing my PhD. Well, I didn't mention that, but I got kind of disenchanted with academia and kind of dropped out because I couldn't get funding for my PhD work, which I was going to do in Arctic Village. Because I'm a lousy grant writer, which I shouldn't even say here on air since I'm trying to sell myself as a writer. But, and I somehow drifted into guiding, you know, just to be able to stay here and make a living. And so when I'm talking about guiding, that's the wilderness guiding I've been doing up there a lot in the Brooks Range. On guided trips, there is never time to explore each tempting vista or route, each peak, glen, or cascade the maps hint at. Chores demand my attention, and I can't ignore the rigid schedule for reaching our destination either. Missing connecting flights home due to weather delays in our bush pickups always galls clients. Also, I have long felt that weekend and even week-long trips are too short to find equilibrium. It takes days to quiet the monkey mind and tune out all concerns of the world left behind, which start to intrude again days before the end of a wilderness journey. I want to stretch the middle part, that time of single-minded, blissful presence as much as humanly possible. I know from Outward Bound courses I have worked that somewhere beyond the two-week threshold where resupplies are necessary if you are not in a boat, roaming will transform, if not you, then the nature of the endeavor from a pastime into a primeval passage. At that point, you settle into the itinerant life as if it's the only one you've ever known. Camp chores, like locking the door of your home when you leave, no longer require conscious effort. Despite the occasional hardship, the landscape through which you move fits like a glove. Competence lies at the core, with a mental component, a confident ease that can still get you into trouble. Last, I long for a block of time with no distractions or obligations, an opening in which I can ponder my place in the great chain of beings. I desired this trial and opportunity as a 50th birthday present, but hesitated year after year because I earned most of my money in 3 months of guiding and can ill afford to take most of a summer off. And frankly, I dislike and dread logistics, which for this expedition are complex and crucial. Eventually, uncannily, 3 key events got my rear end into gear. They alerted me to the fact that time keeps on slipping into the future, in Steve Miller's psychedelic words, and that I will get neither younger nor fitter. So the 3 events, to sum up the rest of that chapter, were that The first was on a river trip with Inupiaq activist and wilderness guide Robert Thompson from Kaktovik, with whom I've guided a trip. And we were on the Hula Hula, sitting at camp, kind of stranded because we had launched the day before and the water was so low that we were pondering whether we should even continue the trip or just fly out from the next airstrip downstream. And so we were sitting around camp after dinner and just, you know, talking about dreams and stuff. And I came up with, you know, when my turn came, I said, well, my dream for quite a while has been this Arctic traverse, you know, from the Canadian border to the Kotzebue Sound. But I just can't make it work financially because I don't have any big time sponsors. And this woman, the client on the trip, she pipes up and she says, we'll get you the money. Don't worry about it. We'll get you the money. So she was working for some kind of land conservation organization, and she was good as her word. She got me the money, and so I kind of was in. I couldn't back out anymore. Blame it on not having the funds for it. That was the first one. And then on another trip I did there, that I guided there, and a High Peaks, we call it the High Peaks trip, from the Upper Sheenjack over the Continental Divide and down to Grassers, the airstrip on the Hula Hula. I had a woman who was a high school teacher from back east, and she fell really in love with the place. She was just sitting outside of her tent for hours after dinner and just looking at the light change, and she wanted to really come back and see more of it and see the northern lights. It was her first time in Alaska, and also get grant money to bring some of her students up. And one day she came to me and she complained about some chest pains that she had, and she didn't have a mechanism of injury where she could have fallen or pulled a muscle or anything, or the pack wasn't too heavy. So I just gave her some basic painkillers, ibuprofen. And she'd also mentioned repeatedly that she had a type of skin cancer. So she had lesions on her forearms that she showed us. And you know, that sort of like brought it together, her recurring cancer, and then how much she loved being up there and how hard it was for her to get up there. And that said to me, you know what, I always operated under the assumption that there's always more time to do these things. You know, if I don't do, like I said, I wanted to do the traverse on my 50th birthday. And at that point I was already 53. I said, well, maybe I'll do it on my 60th, you know, but her story and her experience was sort of like a memento mori for me that, no, we do not have all the time. If you have something that you want to do, you better jump it and do it fast and do it right this minute, you know, of course, with a little bit of preparation. And the third incident happened on that same trip with her when we ended up hiking down to Grassers and for our pickup by the charter plane. And I came upon a guy there that was picking up a cache for him that had been left there. And I walked up to him and I harumphed so that he would notice my presence, because people they react. They might spray you in the face or shoot you if they think you're a bear creeping up on them. Anyway, it turned out this guy was that mythical creature that I always heard about and never encountered. He was a thru-hiker. He was him and a friend that already had hiked ahead. We're doing this traverse that I had only talked about and dreamt of. And I looked at the guy and yeah, he was fit, you know, and everything, but he was no Superman, you know, he was no Charles Bronson. And I said, you know, I felt like a tourist compared to that guy. We had just done a pretty ambitious 9-day backpacking trip across the Continental Divide. But next to him, I felt sort of like the kind of guy that is on a tour bus with a microphone, you know? And so those were the things that all came together, the funding and these role models or heroes, if you want to call them that. And that's actually what in the end, you know, got my behind in the gear. And, you know, like I say, it's a totally different ball game, though, when you do it solo. I have to say that psychologically, and then also never having that second opinion when you think you need it, you know, when you do, am I going the right way or not? It's nice to have a second pair of eyes and a second brain once in a while.
But talking about that, there's advantages to being solo too, right?
Yes, you do. You're always the fastest and the weakest member or the slowest member of the group. So you don't have to wait for slow pokes, you know, that can't get out of the sleeping bag in the morning. And also it does something psychologically. You know, I notice when you're out with people, even when you're not guiding, when it's just friends or family, you do tend to focus a lot on other people instead of on what's around you, you know. So I think from a writer's perspective and from a naturalist perspective, there's a lot more to gain by going by yourself. And then also that challenge, you know, how do I, me is all I have, you know, I'm the resource and I have to make good use. I have to face every situation and be able to deal with it. It's, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging about it. There's nice parts about going with people too, especially like educating, you know, when you do an education and stuff. It's nice to see that light bulb go off or that interest spark in another person, but going solo is psychologically, it's a very different ball game.
Yeah, and the risk factor too. You mentioned making decisions, but I would imagine, well, I know you have to be way more conservative in your what the decisions you
Yeah, it
make, right?
is. I mean, they have, you know, Park Service and people like that, they advise actually against going out by yourself. You know, for one thing, you do tend to be a little safer in groups when it comes to bear encounters, which are, you know, the bears are easier intimidated or think twice about approaching. Whereas if you're a single person, you know, it's a one-on-one situation for them. And the other thing is just any kind of injury, really, you know, it can screw you up. If you lie somewhere and for some reason your communication devices don't work, nobody doesn't know exactly where to look for you. I didn't leave a detailed itinerary with anybody either because I was trying to keep my options open. And, you know, you do little detours or explorations, and I didn't want to be tied to any one single fixed itinerary. So, yeah, there's a lot more risk involved. But I don't know as far as making more conservative decisions. I've never learned that skill quite yet in the outdoors.
Well, also, this was 2012, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, communication wasn't as good back then either. We didn't necessarily have inReaches and the technology we have today.
Well, I did actually have a satellite phone that I did borrow from Robert Thompson, my friend there in Kaktovik that I mentioned, but it was. More of a curse than a blessing. The thing really malfunctioned. There was sometimes it dropped communications between within every minute, you know, it got cut off. And so it was not something you really could rely upon, but it was certainly good to have it. I had some problems with caches that weren't where they were supposed to be, and that could have really screwed me up without a satellite phone. But other than that, yeah, there was no inReach, or it was just the maps and the phone. And like I said, the phone half the time didn't work.
And logistics, you had caches along the way that were flown in, right? And that's
I
the
had
main thing, right?
six, I had six caches total, and of those, five were flown in, or were supposed to get
Right.
flown in. One ended up being driven up on the haul road because the outfitter screwed up, and then one I mailed to myself at the post office at Anaktuvuk Pass, which is the only village I cross. I came to. That's the Nupiaq village in the heart of Gates of the Arctic, so I just mailed it to myself there, general delivery, and then picked it up when I hiked through. But yeah, so I wasn't on the plane when the caches got dropped, so all I had was GPS coordinates from the pilots,
Yeah.
and that caused some of those problems finding some of those caches.
Yeah, that's a little nerve-wracking. I am Paul Torlat. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm with Michael Engelhardt, author of the soon-to-be-released book Arctic Traverse, about his hike and paddle from Canada to Kotzebue. We'll be right back after this short.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's gonna be the feel everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th.
Right.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and we are talking to Michael Englehart, the author of Arctic Traverse. Michael, so we've talked about your background. We've talked about sort of the genesis of this book and a little bit about the trip. So let's start. Let's start with your day one. It was a pretty exciting day, I think.
Yeah, that chapter is called A Warm Welcome. I arrived at Joe Creek in the far eastern Brooks Range 1 month before Independence Day, still beholden to clock time at 5 p.m. The sun hangs high in the northwestern quadrant, 2 weeks from its tipping point back into winter. Caribou graze placidly scattered across the tundra. When the propeller has stuttered to a standstill, I unlatch the door and step out of the fat-tired Cessna and receive my gear, which I drop beside the runway. Before Kirk Switzer climbs back in to disappear, the suave, gray-haired, clean-shaven owner-operator of Yukon Air Service warns me that Joe Creek is Barry. Within minutes of landing at the start of my traverse, the first bruin pops up at the airstrip. I'm still fiddling with my pack, transferring enough provisions from my bear-proof food barrel for a day's hike east to the Canada border. He rears for a better view, catches my scent, and scoots. I leave the barrel at the strip to lighten my load, planning to get it upon my return. In an arcane calculus of pack weight, finances, caloric needs, and the nature of the terrain, I determined that I'll need 6 caches along my planned route to Kotzebue. Each holds supplies for roughly 9 days, except for the final one on the river, which should last for 2 weeks. A total of 7 bears, counting cubs, cross my path within the next 4 hours. Number 5 gallops up to me from the stream bottom, curious and confident, looking very excited. I unholster my spray can, the fastest gun in the north, before this subadult turns and flees. Another bear spooks some caribou cooling off on the off ice, the stream's shield of frozen overflow layers that might linger all summer. I tread on mats of tiny pink stars and white mini urns, alpine azalea and bearberries. It can't be avoided. I'll see the latter fruit into purplish black spheres amongst scarlet leaves if I live long enough. So that was the warm welcome right there. And like I said, that was a 7-bear day, which I had a few on this trip. That I, on average, I saw a bear every other day. That evening, I didn't quite make it to the Canadian border. I camped and I tried to call my girlfriend, Melissa, from the hillside on the satellite phone because I really needed some human company. It was sort of like a shock being thrown into like that, right into the frying pan. And I couldn't get through to her because the phone malfunctioned or she wasn't home. I can't remember which. And I was really sort of like really down and really worried too about what this was going to be. This was just the first day. And I had almost as an afterthought on the way to the airport, flying out to Joe Creek, I had stopped a friend that had driven me, had stopped at Fred Meyer here in town, and I bought a folding knife because I didn't even have other than a nail clipper, any kind of self-defense tool for close combat. You know, you can't use a bear spray inside a tent. So that evening, I clutched that open folding knife, had it next to me, and I honestly didn't think I was going to make it through the night. But you always do, and you wake up, and it's a new day and a new beginning, you know?
That's a great day one. Well, I don't know if it's great, yeah. But yeah.
Half a day, yeah.
So let's talk about naturalists a little bit and the significance of bears, because you write a lot about the bears and their significance in indigenous culture, the significance to you, and your relationship with them on the trip. Why are they important to you besides, obviously, safety?
Bears is like, the bears are a symbol up here. You know, it's an ecosystem in which bears originally occurred that does not have any more bears is impoverished. And that's the biological factor, but there's also a psychological factor, because traveling in an environment that does not have any large predators that can terminate your life, you know, it puts you in the middle of the food chain, and it just makes you pay more attention to your surroundings and makes you feel more alive. That's, you know, you develop an instinct over time. Like there was another episode halfway through the trip where I was hiking down along a creek side and on a game trail. And for some unspecified reason, I just felt the urge to cross on the other side of the creek. And it wasn't like that there was the going was any easier. There was no obvious reason for why I felt I needed to do that. And I did anyway. And coming around the corner, sure enough, there was a female bear and three cubs sitting right on the trail feeding there, where I would have right bumped into them if I had not switched. So those kinds of things, that's what bears will do for you. You know, you watch them for safety reasons, but also you're so much more tuned into the environment. Some of the other reasons why bears are just endlessly fascinating is because they remind you of us in a lot of ways. I mean, they're the physical resemblances. There's the, you know, when they're upright on two legs, there's the old saw that a skinned bear looks almost like a naked person. They do, but would be more like a Neanderthal. Their mothering is very similar to ours. They breastfeed with their cubs on their chest. They play. So all these things, you know, there's a reason why bears and people have been associated with each other through different cultures for centuries. And even before that traverse, I'd spent 4 years just writing a cultural history of the polar bear, another book where I looked at how people have related over the millennia with bears, anything from demonizing them to worshiping them. So that is almost so deeply in us, embedded in us, this fascination with bears, that I would almost call it a species memory or genetic by this point. You know, the cave bears that we hid out from, yet at the same time depicted in cave art and also worshipped.
Yeah.
And the one more thing is that in no other animal in the wilds have I noticed individual personalities as easily as I do in bears. And mm-hmm. you don't even, you know, everybody knows their dog has a personality. And when you work with horses, you realize different horses have different personalities. But in wild animals, that's a little harder to determine or to detect. For one thing, because we don't usually spend extended periods of time with them. And the amazing thing with bears is even a short encounter, you can tell that this bear, how this bear responds and what it does and what it doesn't do is the result of an individual mind and cogitation. I can see how their mind is working. What am I going to do? Am I going to approach that guy? Am I going to chase him? You know, I'm going to circle around here, try to get a whiff of him. So that they are individuals, and you realize that when you meet them.
One of the comments in the book that I liked was that how an animal looks at us and how we look at it, and whether, like, for instance, am I a meal? Am I a threat? Talk about that a little bit. Like, as you were walking and doing this trip, 58 days in bear country, how did your relationship with bears evolve in that regard?
So towards the end, it actually got a little tiresome to be always considered potential dinner by these guys, you know. By that point, I was up on the river on the Noatak, and I felt a little safer because you have your wide open area and you can scan the shore and stuff. But that does not preclude them making efforts to get into close touch with you. I had bears. Sometimes they would just stand up in the willows where you didn't see one before, and they drop down, they're gone. But I also have repeatedly had bears that got into the water and started swimming after me and trying to catch up with me. And I got to a point where I just got a little mad, actually, and started standing up and yelling at those guys. I was starting to take it personal at some level, you know, which might have been malnutrition and just having spent 50 days by myself at that point. But
right.
So the looking, you know, we look at bears, they look at us. We don't know what's going on in their minds. But we do a lot of projecting by looking at animals, you know. And the thing with bears is the visual sense, their eyesight is not the greatest. So they have a much more developed sense of smell. So sometimes I wonder if they get the kind of information from us on a scent, on a breeze of scent molecules that we get by looking at them.
Yeah. And also, I think that's just sort of the whole indigenous idea of animals with spirits. And do you want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, you know, there's that belief widespread throughout the Arctic, actually, not just in Arctic Alaska, that once upon a time, animals lived like people in tribes too, and they could assume human forms and they mingled with people. And there are stories of people and bears intermarrying and having offspring. There's one story up on the Noatak River, for example, that a bear married a human, and the offspring was two different kinds of bears, which turned into polar bears and brown bears or grizzlies. So it's this idea that everything, it's not just the bears, everything out there is animate and everything is powerful. You know, you don't even kick a pile of rocks over, because that rock, there might be a spirit inside that rock. The whole landscape is animate. You know, it's like what Richard Nelson, and you spoke of heroes earlier. Richard Nelson is definitely one of the role models as an anthropologist for me, and also as a writer, because he dropped out of anthropology, became a radio person and a writer. And he has that idea of the, where he did the series about the Koyukon Athabascans, the forest has eyes. And so the tundra has eyes too, and everything is animate, and you don't mess with these powers, you know. Bears were so powerful that in a lot of cultures, after they get killed, and that's what a lot of people don't understand, they can be sacred, but you can also kill them, and they're just, it's the way the killing is done that matters, you know. It's the respect that you pay the animal, and that you return its bones to a certain place for a time, or don't speak ill of it. I mean, we are caught in this conundrum, you know. We, in order to live in an environment that is poor in plant resources, we have to kill. We have to kill animals and live off their meat. But we also acknowledge this kinship by saying basically that all life is sacred, including the bear's life, and we have to make restitution for that. And so, you know, when a bear takes a human life, then that's okay too. That's all part of this cycle, which is not exactly how Western culture feels. If we have a hiker that gets killed by a bear, they all hell breaks loose to try to track down that bear and basically kill that bear, based on the myth that they develop a taste for human flesh, which is, frankly speaking, bogus.
Yeah. Yeah, super interesting. Let's move on from bears. And you also talk about, one interesting thing was about birds. And you comment a couple of times that sort of a place without birds is like hell. And the thing that I liked about this, we'll talk about writing a little bit here, is you narrate, you have each day, 58 days, not every single day in here, but a lot of them. And you have a little bit about your route and what you're doing that day. But almost every little mini chapter is you've come across something. It might be lichen, it might be a fox, it might be a loon or a bird, and then you expound on that. Was that sort of your intent in the book, like to bring that natural history that sort of intimately into the book?
It is my way of writing, actually. You know, it came out of the note taking, of course. You know, that you record the things you see. And you should not underestimate the little things, because as Aldo Leopold said, everything is tied together, you know, when you pull on the thread and everything hangs on that same thread. So you can actually have a little thing like lichen or a flower, and you look into it, and the next thing you find that lichen is actually an indicator for air quality and for environmental health, you know. So you can use the little things to talk about big things and to think about big things too. You know, there is no really small stuff out there. Everything is of equal importance, really. And the beauty of birds and flowers and such things is that they're so ubiquitous. You know, even in the city, there's usually some kind of bird within sight and some kind of flower that blooms somewhere. And our society is so impressed with gigantism and the charismatic stuff that we often, unfortunately, overlook the little things. And I use them as teaching tools too. Like a favorite thing that I used to do, which may be a little nerdy, is that when I'm out guiding people and they ask me, what's this flower's name? What's that flower's name? You know, and sometimes people think by knowing a thing's name, you know its story, you know, that you can just file it away. I know what it is, I know where it occurs, so I know it, I don't have to deal with it anymore. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Edward Abbey, another one of my so-called heroes, at least when it came to writing, he said it would take a whole lifetime to write the biography of just a single juniper tree.
Huh.
So
yeah.
these things have stories that are incredibly complex. And so what I do sometimes, instead of, I said to that client, well, I can't tell you the name of this flower, but what would that do for you really? What I'd like you to do is sit there for 5 minutes and look at it and then tell me what you would name it. What would your name be for it? And that forces them to actually not just get a name and consume another thing, but to sit down and quiet down and look and be more creative and engage actually with that little thing that grows out there under these incredible conditions, you know. And that's the thing, flowers, they impress me just by how fleeting they are, they're blossoming, and then the conditions under which they bloom, you know. In the starkest alpine landscape or sand dunes, there's still a good chance you stumble upon some flowers.
Yeah. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. We're talking to Michael Engelhardt, and his book, Ardent Traverse, is about his trip from Canada to Kotzebue across the Brooks Range. So that sort of brings up a thought, Michael, talking about sort of those little things about what you're seeing as you're walking. So I want to talk a little bit about the mode of transport. So for a little over half the trip, you're hiking, and then you got to, you crossed the Haw Road, which is the only road you cross, which is amazing. You cross the whole state and only cross one road. And then you went to one village, Anetuvik Pass, and then you're on the Noatak. So I was really interested in the sort of the change in your relationship with the land between hiking and I'm floating on a river.
Well, for one thing, you get to exercise different muscle groups.
Yeah.
But I was actually looking forward after, two-thirds. It's actually more like two-thirds on land and one-third on the river. And I was actually looking really forward to the river part because, the hiking is really brutal out there. And, of course, I'd forgotten from previous trips that the boating on the Noatak where it gets windy can be just as brutal. So, but the perception of the environment, you know, it's sort of like a mobility thing because when you're hiking, you for one thing, you have less free attention to pay to your environment, you know, in order to really pay attention to what's outside the radius that is just in front of your feet, where you need to watch where you're stepping. You have to stop actually and look around. Whereas on a boat, you can sit and the scenery just floats by, you know, on a day where the wind isn't blowing so hard that you're actually going back up river, and then it's still floating by. And when you want to get a 360-degree view on a river, you just spin around, you know, and you get a real easy 360-degree view. Or when I'm taking my notes on my maps on the river, I'm still traveling. I'm still making miles. So those are some of the obvious differences, of course.
Yeah. When I think you talk about the minutiae, the small things you notice, you're probably, I imagine, noticing smaller things while you're hiking because you're traveling a lot slower.
That was the case, you know, where you're far from the riverbank usually, and so you don't have that microscopic perspective unless you land and do lunch or you take a break or something. But
yeah, one of the other things,
the thing though, it's a lot easier to sneak up on wildlife deliberately or not when you're in a boat because you're quieter and you can just sit there and approach them. And they won't even recognize sometimes they're not hardwired to consider you a threat if you come from the river, if you're not upright like a predator, like a bear, or like walk like a wolf. So I've had actually some of the best wolf encounters just going down the Noatak and sometimes traveling for 5 minutes or longer in the company of a wolf that was skimming the river edge looking for food morsels while I was just trying to keep pace and accompanying that wolf. So that was pretty neat. You don't get that so much when you're on land.
Yeah, you have a great passage about the eyes of the wolf and what they're sort of looking at and how their intelligence in their eyes.
It's almost like a physical connection. And you can totally see again when you're meeting wolves in the wilds, up close, you can totally see how there's this old bond that started in mutual curiosity when we encountered wolves and they encountered us. And then that turned into something where maybe they started following us and hang around our camps and starting to eat scraps from our tables. And then eventually we, the question is, did they domesticate us or did we domesticate them and turn them into dogs? You know, you could look at it both ways. Dogs get a free meal and protection from other animals too. So, yeah. And oftentimes, you know, pet owners, they're at their pet's beck and call. So I'm asking you, who domesticated who?
Who knows? What are some of the, back to the trip in the book, I mean, I'm also was fascinated. You bring a lot of history, human history, into this. And sort of the changes in indigenous cultures after contact and various folks. You talk about Amundsen, doing the Northwest Passage and coming down to Eagle. Talk about that a little bit. Why have that in there? What's important about that?
Well, it's these you get these different overlays on the landscape, and a real good indicator for what these layers are that is actually easily accessible is the place names. I talk a lot of times about the place names on the map, and there's this old adage that goes, naming is claiming. So whoever gets to put their name on nowadays a map or a landscape has a claim to that landscape. And so up in the Arctic, there's a book called Where the Mountains Are Nameless, and Bob Marshall in the Central Brooks Range went about, like, he invented that place and named this mountain and that mountain and that mountain, thereby claiming it, really. But what he knew, he must have known, because he knew a lot of Native people up there, was that a lot of these places already had Native names. The mountains may not have been climbed, because any sane hunter or gatherer would say, why would I go up a mountain? There's nothing to eat up there for me, you know? That does not mean that those mountains and the names they had were not important to them. They were very much so, because that's where the culture resides, whether it's Native culture and to a degree also the non-Native culture resides in those place names. It's what makes a space human, is putting names on certain features in the landscape. So Native people use these landmarks, these named landmarks, to orient themselves as a mnemonic device. When they were traveling, they knew, now Cold Mountain, Alapa Mountain comes up, and I need to hang a right up this river valley here, or this creek valley, to go to the Peregrine Pass, which I don't know what their name for that was. So the individual and the cultural identity resides in those places. A lot of those places, they have stories associated with them of important things that happened there. And by revisiting these places, you kind of reactivate or reenact the history of those places. And also, of course, by teaching your children the names of those places, you pass that legacy on to the next generation. And up there, the way white people, and it was mostly white men originally, came into their country, to them it was not only terra incognita, unknown country, but also unclaimed country. And nothing could be further from the truth. Just because their maps showed nothing but white spots, that place was densely cultivated, if you want to call it that. I mean, it's not our idea of cultivation. They weren't tilling fields, but people were, they knew that land inside out, and they traveled it and they read it like a book. And every creek, every mountain, was known and probably had a name and a story that went with it.
Yeah. That's been a real insight for me in the last few years, is that everywhere we go, there's a story. There, it might be a meadow where moose hang out or whatever, and I think you in this book do a very good job of illustrating that.
I take that even further. I'd say everything has a story, and then usually when you start looking into that, there's a story behind the story.
Yeah.
And so at some point you just got to cut it off, because you can't never tell all these stories. And that's personally for me one of the reasons why I'm a nonfiction writer, not a fiction writer, because there are already all these great stories out there, and my job is just to find them and to tell them in an entertaining way. I don't need to make up stuff. There's stuff that's more, to me, more bizarre and more unlikely than stuff that other people invent. It's just a matter of finding these stories and bringing them to the public.
We have a few minutes left, Michael. Again, we're talking Michael Englehart, his book Art at Traverse is coming out from the Mountaineers. Let's end with the You have a lot of, you have some opinions in the book, and particularly about the sort of petroleum hydrocarbon society that we're in. So I don't know if in a few minutes you can talk a little bit about that and how, in one hand, we're, you know, you're obviously we're using carbon-based, you know, clothing, and we're relying on airplanes, but on the other hand, the threats that it also brings to a place like the Arctic.
Yeah. So let that be my disclaimer. Like, if you are still denying, not you personally, but as a reader, if you're still denying what's going on in the Arctic and globally as far as the climate, then this book is probably not for you. You probably don't want to spend that money for that book. That said, we're all implicated, and I make a note of that myself, actually, that I point fingers, but I'm part of the problem. We're all part of the problem. We can also be all part of the solution. A lot of that gear, or even just the expense and the energy of flying up there, chartering planes, flying up there, the rafts are made out of hypalon, which is a fossil fuel material. You know, our gear, Gore-Tex, everything is now plastic or fossil fuel products. It's just, to me, there just seems to be no getting away from it. But it's not just a matter that we choose to do this. It's almost like we don't have any options. Yeah, I could not fly there. But then the corporations don't care. They keep making profits and keep wrecking the world, whether I go up there or not. And I justify these things. I don't fly much outside of the Alaska anymore. I do not have children, which is one of the largest contributions to the environment you can make nowadays. So I am aware of the damage I'm doing and my involvement, and I am trying to go to give back in exchange. And my giving back is not, I'm not working well with others, so I'm not getting involved in environmental organizations, also because I really don't think that is going to change the big picture much. I think we missed that boat. But my giving back is by speaking out for these places and informing people about what's going on up there. And I've, even in my little short human perspective up there, I noticed drastic changes over the decades in the Arctic from going there over and over again.
Thank you, Michael. This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I've had Michael Engelhardt on my show here, talking about his book Arctic Traverse, and it's a really impressive book, Michael. I learned a lot in all kinds of aspects, not just the trip itself, but also about the natural history and the cultural history and the political history of the area. Thank you very much for joining us, Michael.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks to my guest, Michael Engelhardt. We'll have a link to his book, Art of Traverse, on the Outdoor Explorer website. Finally, thanks to our excellent producer, Eric Bork. I'm your host, Paul Torda, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, the birds are arriving, spring is coming, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.